Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom. And a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh, modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style, all for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast, free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
This podcast is ad-free and will remain ad-free for the foreseeable future. Instead, what I have done is host a series of virtual investing conferences. And the third one of these is now scheduled for August 11th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. This is an opportunity to hear from established hedge fund managers who will be sharing exclusive stock ideas for attendees of the conference only. And now, for a limited time, listeners of this podcast get a special 10% discount on the price of admission simply by entering the promo code ContrarianPod when they check out. There are more details on this available at the website contrarianpod.com/event. contrarianpod.com/event, and you can make your ticket purchase there directly. So please do that, and I look forward to speaking to you on August 11th for this virtual investing conference that is held in partnership with valuewalk.com. and Breakout Point. Be there.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Siddhartha Singhai of Ironhold Capital Hedge Fund here in New York. Thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. You're here because you have some views that are quite contrarian, affecting a couple of different sectors of the market and of the economy. And these are two sectors here, auto manufacturing and semiconductors, that are cyclical. And if you've been paying any attention at all to the economy, as we all know, the COVID crisis has kind of exacerbated and maybe accelerated the end of the business cycle, some would say, to where a recession is effectively now just about priced in. And the question very much becomes how we can get to grow again in the future and how long it will take before we attain any levels of growth that would positively affect these cyclical industries.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, it's quite contrarian, and I'm quite happy to have you on and talk a little bit about this. So let's maybe start there and tell me why you like these particular industries.
Yeah, just to begin with, thank you for having me on the show. It's a wonderful podcast. I watched a few episodes and it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. So if you look at the macro of the situation right now with COVID, I don't think it's actually priced in yet.
Right.
We had a drop, a 30% drop roughly, and it's come right back up. But when you look at the economy, like the macroeconomics of the economy, just the unemployment rate in itself is the greatest we've had since the Great Depression. So it is not as if the market has priced the recession in. I think it has priced the recovery in. but that recovery hasn't happened yet. So if you look at just the number of people I meet who either have been laid off or have had to take a pay cut, it's just astonishing. And I think the unemployment numbers are like 15 or 16%. And that's understating it because of the way they counted. So I don't think that this is, that we are, and this is obviously with a grain of salt, because any macroeconomic predictions are just predictions, really. There's no way in which we can describe either the timing or the magnitude of these things. That being said, if I were to look at the economy right now, I would think that we would be down 50, 60%, but we are not. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if the market brushed it off. Mm-hmm. Nothing has happened. And I think that could be dangerous for a lot of investors who think that it's over. And we saw that with Mr. Buffett. He did not buy into the dip. And he's seeing all those numbers that have been handed out to him on a monthly or quarterly basis by those 90 or 100 businesses that he has. And the story doesn't look so good there. And I think investors who, I mean, some investors got lucky. I mean, I myself personally did really well doing the correction, but I would attribute that to sheer luck rather than any sort of brilliant foresight.
Okay. So all of which makes it even more contrarian to be bullish on something that is so cyclical, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So then what is the case for these sectors that you like?
Well, if we think about, cyclicality is just naturally a part of almost all businesses. Some businesses are more immune to it than others, like Google or Facebook, they're more immune to it. But we always have these credit cycles, booms and bust cycles in the economy. So that's cyclical. Semiconductors especially are very cyclical. They have these capital expenditure cycles where firms like Texas Instruments, AMD, Intel, and Micron, they do a bunch of capital expenditures in anticipation of the coming demand. Mm-hmm. And I think we are there. Mm. Obviously, the magnitude of how long will we able to take for them to really recover, it's uncertain. But typically, the cycles have been every 3-4 years in the past. So there's going to be a recovery eventually. And I think semiconductor equipment suppliers,
right,
they have a comparative positioning that enables them to benefit from that. The traditional semiconductor companies, their earnings ebb and flow with the cycle,
right,
a lot. For suppliers, they're not that affected because they have a comparative advantage. Mm-hmm. Because it's a commodity, semiconductors and memory, it's all commoditized. They suffer fluctuations that suppliers don't. Mm-hmm. So given the macro, I mean, the only time value investors really benefit is when we get something for less than what it's worth. And the time we had that in the past few months, and we might have it in the future as well. And that's where you have to jump into great businesses. Mm-hmm. That are temporarily out of favor.
Right.
And so I think that's where the contrarianism comes mm-hmm. in. Yes, the long-term prospects of the business are fantastic, I would say, in a few cases. But we will have to come in at a valuation that also makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so this macroeconomic environment will allow us to do that, I would say.
Fair enough. So basically, you say it's a good time to be building positions in these companies?
Well, 3 months ago or even a month and a half ago, it was a fantastic time.
Right.
Right now, I would be a little skeptical. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's already pretty cheap. So pretty much all the semiconductor industry is pretty cheap right now. But then again, it's tricky because we don't know when the market will turn. Mm. on the macro side. But I would say within the next year or so, we might see some opportunities. Because eventually, the economy and the market will have to reconcile with each other. And we don't know when that's going to happen.
Right.
But I would personally hold on to more cash right now.
Right now. Okay. And what about the auto manufacturers? What's the case there? Is it the same situation, you'd say?
It is. Auto hasn't been growing at all over the last almost a decade, I would say, but especially the last 3 or 4 years.
With one exception, Tesla. But okay, go on.
Yeah, that's a wonderful exception. But the industry, if I look at the overall demand for the industry, it's 2%, 3% overall. And over the last 3 or 4 years, it's been a negative 2 or 3%. Which is sort of silly when you look at, especially in the US, we have, as you mentioned, Tesla, we are transitioning to electric cars eventually. So there's going to be, so every 6 to 7 years, people buy another car. And that's typically the cycle. And if you look at on aggregate, every 6 years, you do away with the previous models, the last generation of cars, you move on to the next one. Whenever that happens, this demand that is not satisfied by the suppliers. And in this case, we will have that. We will have a bunch of electric car manufacturers trying to satisfy that demand by jumping into the market. And I think that in itself will lead to handsome revenue growth. Now, it won't be extraordinary, I think. But depending on if it's just an IC engine model, I would not expect it to do much better than 3 or 4% revenue growth. But if it's electric cars, there's very little penetration. I mean, look at the overall car market for electric cars. So there's a considerable room to grow.
Would that also help the semiconductor industry? Because if these cars are going to have, they're all going to have, if they already do have chips and such, and the electrical ones have, I think, even more. So that would be something else, another tailwind for that industry, right?
Yeah, that is actually one of the bigger tailwinds. One was obviously consumer devices, smartphones and tablets.
Right.
And desktop PCs. Second big wave of demand is going to come from auto manufacturers. And that's why I'm bullish on semiconductors over the long run.
Right.
Because you look at that industry, just everything will have a processor in it eventually. Everything, you just watches. Watches have processors now that are far more advanced compared to a decade ago. They can process audio, video, and they can process graphics, and they can process dimensions and navigation. So I think as far as demand is concerned for semiconductors, I think they have a long runway of growth out of them. And yes, auto is a big part of it.
And you have, I should have mentioned that you have some specific stock picks here in both of these two sectors that we're going to get to in a bit. But let's first take a short break, and then we'll come back, and I want to ask you some other questions about how you got to where you are. So let's do that right now.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Okay, we are back. Siddharth Singhai of Iron Hold Capital This is the segment of the show where our guest tells us a little bit more about himself or herself, how they got to this state of their career. So, yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yep. So I did my undergrad in mechanical engineering from India. And after that, I worked for about 2 years as a lead equity research analyst for a financial advisory firm in India. And after that, I came to New York to pursue master's in global finance from Fordham University. And that's where I met my business partner, Paul. And we were both interested in our own venture, entrepreneurial ventures. And for us, the logical progression was starting our own investment firm. And so that's what we are doing, and we call it Iron Hole Capital. So we typically have two portfolios. One is a private real estate portfolio where we have two or three big commercial real estate opportunities a year that we look into. And the second one is the equity portfolio, which is sort of where we differentiate ourselves. So we call it global deep value.
Okay.
And we invest both in US and India. And we typically pick 150, 300 stocks in both of those countries combined. And these are high quality businesses, employ very little or no leverage, that we are buying for 60 to 70 cents on a dollar. And the unique thing about GDV is that in India, you only have about less than 500 mutual funds and hedge funds combined, but you have 5,000 public listed securities. In the US, you have 3,700 listed securities, roughly, and more than 10,000 mutual funds and hedge funds combined. So for a value investor, the less followed a stock, the greater is the probability that it would be cheap on the value. And so India sort of resembles US of the 60s, 70s, before we had Bloomberg. We had news all the time on TV, financial news, and people would trade in and out of positions quickly. You had to call up your broker. You had to, he would give you the information for the stock. It would be sent to your house. When we had that, it allowed people like Mr. Buffett to just go through Moody manuals and find stocks selling for less than liquidation value. And we can sort of find those opportunities in India right now. Not so much in the US because of the just number of eyes on those particular
securities. Of course, this begs the question if you have any ideas in India that you're open to discussing too.
Sure. In India, I think the biggest, I would say the most profitable industry would be asset management.
Okay.
In the future, just looking at the regulations, there's a huge barrier to entry. They get regulated by SEBI, which is India's version of SEC. And they're very strict. You have to have a certain AUM. You have to have, you have to comply with a whole bunch of regulations, and it's a high barrier to entry if you want to get into that mutual fund industry in India. And that sort of naturally resolves into an oligopoly type structure. A few firms servicing many customers. And in addition to that, when we look at just the number of people who actually invest in the stock market in India, I think less than 6% of India's population actually invest in the stock market, compared to, I think, almost 50% in the US. So that will change because India is also the fastest growing economy. When typically the GDP of a country doubles, the disposable incomes grow by 10 times. It's an exponential increase. And I think over the next two decades, we'll see a lot of money going to going into asset management and, you know, financial advisory services that we don't see right now. So just in terms of the runway for growth, for asset management in India. It's wonderful. And so that's one industry. Other one I would say is manufacturing and more or less, especially energy, energy production. And that, I mean, the big bottleneck that India had compared to China was that our power grids weren't as developed. And so if you were to start your own business that was manufacturing heavy, you won't be able to get the electricity, the power supply, the load factors were not up to the mark. And it just wasn't available 24 hours a day. And in a lot of places, it still isn't. So I would also be a, I would look keenly into that power sector in India, because till now it was monopolized. It was just one company supplying 90% of the power to Coal India. It was a monopoly. Now it's no longer a monopoly. And people can actually, they had captive mines that other people will now come in and, you know, start production there. So that sort of allows for better competition and better pricing.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously better technology that U.S. companies will bring to India.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, I think, the two, I mean, broadly speaking, the most attractive industries that I see in India.
Very interesting. Is now, you think, maybe a good time to invest in India? I mean, it's a little bit less connected to the global kind of supply chains than China is. You know, the economy, obviously you know more about this than I do, but the, unlike China's economy, which is very much or has been historically geared towards manufacturing as a factory to the world, India has been a lot more self-contained, and also as an importer of energy, which might be a good time now with energy prices a little cheaper. So is this a good time to be investing in India, you think?
It's a wonderful time to be investing in India because of a few things. One, the markets are really inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Penetration of financial services isn't as high. So you got a few eyes looking at number of stocks. Second is the regulations. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the accounting standards in India, at least in the mid cap and above that, mid to large cap, are pretty, in my view, exceptional. They're almost on par with what we have in the US. So you get great accounting, you also get financial information quickly, and you also have a market that is inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Add to that, India is growing at 6%, 7% GDP growth. You add to that inflation, that's almost 12, 13%. You add to dividend yield of 1.5%, 2%. The Indian market will grow at 15, 16% and has historically.
Mm-hmm.
So I think right now, especially if you are a value-based investor, or even if you're not, even if you're a growth investor, I think it's a great way to get returns.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when we look at the US, we look at, I think we're looking at 8%, 7 to 8% over the next decade, two decades.
Right.
Over the next decade, especially, I would not expect high returns at all. We've had terrific returns over the past decade. But I think anytime the market grows much faster than the GDP, it then eventually has to, that both of those things have to be in equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
So it slow down, it will have to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
So
It's interesting. I've been to India, actually, and partly to cover... Wonderful. An attempt to cover hedge funds there. And as you know, there's not many there, and the ones that are there are very small, but there are many that are offshore that trade India, in Mauritius of all places, and in Singapore also, there are a lot of them. Is that something, and it is partly because of the very regulated asset management industry.
You nailed it.
Is that changing at all, you think, or is that still just, is it still just a very high barrier to entry?
Yeah, I mean, just to give you an example, we don't have, I mean, the name we have for hedge funds in India is PMS.
Right.
And if I were to start a PMS, I would need a net worth of $700,000. I would need to pay a fee of around, converted to USC, it would be in excess of $15,000 every 3 years. No, that's the application fee. Right. And then you have to pay another fee every 3 years to just keep your registry, renew your registration. Your minimum investment in the fund is, I think, 50 lakh rupees, which would be around $70,000. Now, for a population with, you know, much lower per capita GDP wealth, I think that combination of those things, it just makes it very difficult for anyone to get started within the industry. It's a huge barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because it sort of also excludes people like me who do want to do it, but you just can't do it. So essentially, you have to practically be a millionaire to actually start a PMS there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why a lot of people go to Singapore or Mauritius. If one was to break into the industry, you would have to satisfy the capital requirements.
Sure.
The AUM requirements. And those are sort of hefty, especially if you are looking to start your own mutual fund.
Mm.
So you already have to be established. So I think Fidelity. Just the top three or four big mutual funds would be able to do it.
Uh-huh. But they aren't there yet.
They aren't there yet, yes. Because uh-huh. That's why it's an interesting industry. We already have someone like HDFC AMC, which is the premier one. ICICI has one. So they already have achieved economies of scale.
Mm-hmm.
The fee net of everything, I think, is like 0.9% management fee. As a new player coming in, I don't have that benefit of scale. They can just lower it down. Yeah. Now, obviously, it's regulated. The fee is regulated. You can't keep cutting it, but it still is a sizable barrier to entry. But that is also subject to change. I mean, they might deregulate it. So it sort of is a natural oligopoly within the mutual fund sector.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then those could make for interesting, I mean, those two companies, which I think until recently were they had ADRs in the US, in the HDFC and IC. They may still, I can't remember.
Yep. I don't think the asset management division had it.
Oh, no, not that, bank. Right. Just the bank, right.
Bank, yeah.
Right, okay, yeah. Okay, cool. Well, that was an interesting segue, but let's get back to what we were talking about at the outset, these companies. Yeah, so let's have it then. What are the companies that you like here now?
I think for semiconductors, it would be pretty much all of these suppliers. So Lam Research, Tokyo Electron, ASML Holdings, Applied Materials. I personally like Lam Research the best.
Okay.
Mainly because they have... So their moat really is that they've been doing it a long time. There's economies of learning. The manufacturing process of those equipment for semiconductors is very complicated. Just the air has to be so pure that you can't even breathe into it. It has to be like, I think, 1,000 times more, sterile than an operation theater. And then it's all these machines operate on really tiny measurements, nanometers. So just the barrier to entry based on that is pretty high. Then they also have switching costs. So if I have to build out, if I'm AMD, if I'm Intel, and I'm getting my equipment from Lam, it's not like they'll send you the machine. They'll have to come in there, install it, make sure the temperature and the air and everything is correct. Otherwise, it just interferes with the production process. So it's a very integrated way of working with their customers. So it builds up the switching costs. Be hard for them to go to some other supplier that hasn't made its name yet. The other great thing is economies of scale. If you look at Lam Research, they need maybe $300 to $400 million a year they have to invest back into the business, capital expenditure, working capital. And they make like $3 billion on that investment. If you look at the incremental return on invested capital, it's in excess of 1,000%. For the average firm, it's 10%. That to me is, in addition to just the long runway for growth they have, it just makes them a solid candidate, I would say, for compounding your money. And they're also, in my estimation, are trading at 30 to 40% discount right now.
Really?
So, okay. Yeah. So it's, it would be similar to buying Google for 30% of a discount. And so I think it's insane valuation there.
Very interesting. Yeah. Ticker is LRCX. And you say that it's a 30% discount. It's trading near its all-time high, I think, which is around 300 and some, almost 327 as we speak here on Thursday, July 9th.
That's why it's fascinating.
And there is a dividend there, which is, I think, pretty unusual for a stock like this, right? Yeah, pretty sizable, actually. Well, 1.3% at current prices, but that's an interesting. That's very interesting. Why is it that they have such a monopoly, I guess, on these on their suppliers or on their clients, their customers?
It's all of those things combined. So, semiconductors is you have incremental improvements in technology. So they get faster every year. They get more energy efficient every year. So the Moore's law used to work until, I think, very recently, where we moved to 5 nanometer, where it sort of stopped working. So you have to make it, if I'm the competitor for Lam, I'll have to make it cheaper and I'll have to make it better than them, which if you look at the economies of scale, just the fixed costs for Lam are like tiny compared to just the revenue. They have $400 million of fixed costs and they generate billions of dollars of revenue on it. It allows them to do it really cheaply. They're very far down the cost curve. Combined to that, the switching costs, but just the way you have to produce this equipment, you know, it's very, very complicated. It's way pure environment. And you have to work closely with the customers. I think those few things put together put them in a really strong competitive positioning.
Cool. All right. And what about the other one on the automotive front?
Yep. So Lear Corporation, they are an automotive seat supplier. And they supply to practically all major OEMs. The great thing about, it's not, to me, as good as Lam, but it's still trading at a huge discount. We look at the earnings yield. I think they make around $700 to $800 million normalized, and they're trading for $6 billion. That's almost a 15% yield, 13 to 15% yield. And so, if you look at the market, which is discounting it at 10%, they're trading at around almost 50% discount. So there's 100% upside, and the yield is really strong. The other great thing about Lear is that they are, again, an oligopoly. For Lear, there's only one real competitor, and that's Magna International. Apart from that, I mean, even if we compare the margins, Lear has better operating margins, net margins than Magna, far better return on invested capital than Magna. And even for Lear, the return on invested capital is in excess of 50% and has been for a long time, ever since they came out of the restructuring after the Great Recession. So yes, it's not a great, I mean, they also have the tailwind in terms of they have electrical division that supplies electrical components for automotives. So only about 25% right now, but that has some tailwind to it. Yes, the core seed business is not going to grow very rapidly. It's going at about 3-4%. But just how cheap it is compared to how high quality that business is, to me, it's a great investment.
Yeah. And there, the entry point may be a little bit more advantageous than with Lam. It's trading around 102 as we record this, which is well down from its highs that it set. It was up near 140, I guess, earlier in the year or late last year, maybe. So it's not as low as it was in March, but then what is, right?
Yep.
Very interesting. Okay. And you figure that electric or gas or whatever, self-driving, you're still going to need seats in automobiles one way or another. So
yeah, that is actually,
there's probably some stickiness there, one would think.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. All right. Siddharth Singhai, thank you so much for joining the podcast. And in closing, how can our listeners find out more about you? You are not active very much on the social media, are you? I know you're on LinkedIn.
Yes. We are active. We actually have a podcast of our own called Leaders in Business and Investing.
Oh. Okay.
And people can reach out to Arnold Capital at arnoldcapital.com. We have a LinkedIn page that they can reach out to. And they can find us on YouTube through our YouTube channel, which is Leaders in Business and Investing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. I have a YouTube channel too. Oh, that's neat.
Wonderful.
Awesome. Well, great. Well, this is wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.